Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. You're listening to episode 138 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by a couple of co-hosts. First up, Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Well, good evening. It's great to be here, and where am I? Oh, Chicago, yes. We're still waiting for spring.
Absolutely. Also with us is Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog.
Good evening, and welcome.
The fourth member of our little team, David Vanderhoof, is off tonight. We expect to have him back next week. Our guest this episode is Jeff Ackland. He's the president of New Century Aerosport and is a producer of the Radial Rocket Airplane Kit. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Hi, Max. Thanks for the invitation. Glad to be with you this evening.
Now, the Radial Rocket, I guess I would consider that to be a two-place performance and aerobatic plane with this interesting nine-cylinder radial engine in the nose. You really only have to look at a picture of these to want one. In fact, for our listeners, you should go look. Right now, put us on pause. Go, if you're near the internet, go over to www.radialrocket.com. Take a look at this airplane and then come back.
Unless you're driving.
Yes, then don't go anywhere. All right, coming up, we're going to talk about the aviation news from the past week. First, though, we're going to have our conversation with Jeff. Then we'll have the Australia Desk report from Steve and Grant. And also, Peter Johnson has an Across the Pond segment. And we'll finish up with a little bit of listener mail. But first up, let's have a little conversation about the Radial Rocket. Jeff, my first question is this airplane as much fun to fly as it looks?
It really is a lot of fun to fly. It's the third airplane design that I've kind of developed for other companies and as well as companies I've been an owner with. You know, it's kind of my favorite. The airplane kind of started out as just the smallest package I could put with two seats around that M14 radial engine.
Right.
And it kind of developed into a kit plane after that, but it is fun to fly. I like small airplanes with big engines. That makes for a lot of fun. But if you're really going to enjoy an airplane long term, it has to have a comfortable cockpit, room for baggage and fuel, and it needs to have good flying qualities. So that kind of defines the minimum package for the airplane. But yeah, it is a blast to fly.
You are the designer of this airplane, correct?
I am.
And maybe you could tell us just a little bit about your background in terms of, you know, how did you get to the point where you were able to design airplanes?
Well, it was kind of a circuitous route. In the mid-80s, I bought a glassair kit because, you know, you can get a lot of bang for the buck with a kit plane in terms of performance. I was already a commercial and instrument-rated pilot. I'd done some flight instruction, done some corporate flying. But boy, I guess I just had too many comic books as a kid with, you know, P-51s on the cover and stories about them. And I just like that kind of World War II fighter flavor, high-performance type of aviation. And the glassair was a fixed tailwheel glassair, and I built that. Following that, I built a glassair 3. Then I helped my dad build another glassair 3. And then people started coming to me and wanting me to help them build their airplanes, which I did. And then I was hired to kind of run the shop effort and the design effort on a what was going to be a kit plane, but really it really turned out as a proof of concept airplane. It was a twin-engine, seven-seat push-pull aircraft, pretty good-sized airplane. Kind of did that, and when I was doing that, I had an idea for an airplane I wanted to develop on my own, so I found some financial backers and did that project. And it's just kind of evolved into a point where I've developed these different airplanes. Now, I'm not an aerodynamic engineer or aerospace engineer, but
okay,
I develop the concept for these airplanes. And then we go to very capable structural engineers, aerodynamic engineers to, you know, basically put in the right amount of materials in the right place. If you know the outside dimensions of your airplane, how fast you want to go, how much it's going to weigh, how many G's you want to pull.
Right.
You just plug the numbers into programs that tell you how much material you're going to need in various parts of the airframe.
How long does that process take? I mean, how long does it take to go from, let's say, initial design concept to having the first prototype airplane that you could actually fly?
Well, with the airplanes I've done, it seems to be about a year and a half process.
Huh. That sounds pretty short.
That's when you have a team of people working and you've developed, kind of a plan on how to do it. It can proceed that fast. You know, typically you have to, if it's a composite airplane, which the Radial Rocket is, you have to define and produce the tooling, and then you can pull airframe parts out of the tooling, and that's probably the longest lead time item.
Tell us about engine selection. This is this M14 engine. I guess this was originally a Russian design. Is that right?
It's a Russian designed engine. It's been produced in various forms by various countries, but I think the most common forms of the engine are the 360 horsepower M14P engine, and then the 400 horsepower version of that engine is the M14PF. Now, the only difference between those two horsepower levels is the gearing on the internal supercharger. Spins faster on the PF, makes more boost, makes the 400 horsepower.
The radial engine produces a really nice sound, I think.
I like to call an airplane a Harley with wings.
Yes.
It sounds so good that I actually do this sometimes when I'm taxiing back to the hangar. I open the canopy and I take off my headsets and I just kind of enjoy that deep radial lope. It is really a neat sound.
And you have some video on your site, which I took a look at. In fact, I've got some sounds from that right here. It's fantastic sound.
See, that's the part that clattery sound. That's the part I like. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is.
But Jeff, don't you worry about? I mean, I don't know where the engines are actually coming from now. But what about maintenance? About parts and things like that? Do you have trouble finding mechanics to work on them?
Well, not really. You know, it's a it's a basic engine. It has magneto spark plugs and all the parts that you'd see on an aircraft engine. There are a lot of those engines in the United States, and there are now several service outfits in the U.S. that can sell you parts, overhaul the engines, do a lot of work on them. I read on the web somewhere that there have been more M14 engines produced over the years than all Lycoming and Continental engines combined.
Mm. And these are used on other airplanes, right? Some of the Yak planes use these?
The Yak 52s use the engine. The Sukhoi and Yak aerobatic ships that are still in production use these engines.
Huh.
And in fact, the Russians have put out a spec for a new military trainer, and they've specified a 450-horsepower version of this engine that's been under development. So you're seeing things like electronic fuel injection, electronic ignition come to these engines. And so I think the availability of the engines is good. You can still buy brand new engines. There is the Russians still produce them. There's a factory in Romania that produces new engines. A lot of sources for the engine. If you get on the web and Google the engine, you'll find a lot of sources, parts, maintenance availability. So,
now, does a radial engine have a kind of a different startup sequence?
Well, it does. This engine, I'd never flown a radial engine before. It seems like I'd put about everything else in airplanes. You know, V8s, V6s, Lycomings, Continentals, turbines, but I'd never had experience with the radial. But, you know, I've heard this engine termed as if there is such a thing, a modern radial engine. And it's really pretty easy to live with. The one thing you need to do is you need to pull the engine through before you start it to make sure that the lower cylinders aren't full of oil. That'll ruin your day and your engine right away. But basically, you pull the engine through. We have an electric primer on our engine. The standard M14 carburetor it's kind of like a pressure carburetor, and it has no mixture control. It has automatic mixture control.
Mm.
So I've come to like that a lot. You just don't have to worry about it. And you use the electric primer to prime the engine and hit the starter. And when it catches, you flip the mags on. And, you know, kind of once you get it down, it's a two-handed multi-finger thing, but it's kind of a fun thing to do. And once you've learned how to do it, the engine starts right up.
Now, let's talk a little bit about building these. What kind of skills and experience does a builder need in order to put one of these together successfully?
Well, I think more than anything, anybody who endeavors to build an airplane, no matter what the design is, just has to have a good sense of craftsmanship.
Hmm.
You don't have to be an A&P mechanic. I built my first airplane, and I was just handy. You know, I worked on my cars, and, you know, I worked around the house and
right. So
on and so forth. So I knew how to use tools. And, you know, if you have a good assembly manual and a good kit and a good sense of craftsmanship, you can put together a really nice airplane. A lot of, you know, Oshkosh award-winning airplanes are built by first-time builders.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Are you going to bring this one to Oshkosh this year, Jeff?
Oh, I'm sure we will. We've gone every year. We're in Kansas City, so we're just a few hours down the road, so it's an easy trip for us. Didn't make it last year. That's the first year in many years I didn't.
It's okay. You wouldn't have had any place to park anyway. The place is full of water. So.
Oh, that's yeah. What I heard. Yeah. But anyway, last summer during Oshkosh, we were still converting our demonstrator aircraft to the retractable gear.
Right. The retractable gear is something new. Is that right?
It is. Yeah. The airplane design started out as a fixed tailwheel design. But, you know, so it just seems that over the years, the pilot population is seeing less and less percentage of, you know, high-performance tailwheel qualified guys. And really, doing the retractable radial rocket was more about putting a nose wheel on the airplane than it was about retracting the gear.
Ah.
But I can tell you, it will not in this universe or in my lifetime would that airplane have a fixed tricycle gear. It just had to be a retract.
So it's not going to be a radial cirrus?
No.
Okay.
No.
That's too bad, actually, what you said about the fact that there aren't a whole lot of people that do the tailwheel work anymore. I spent a lot of time doing that, and I miss that ability to even go out and fly one. But, I mean, I talk to people about it, and they're afraid of them because they've been out of the market so long that they have no idea what we're even talking about.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I think the radial rocket with the fixed tailwheel gear is a very easy tailwheel airplane to fly. The main gears are widely spaced. It has a steerable tailwheel way back there on kind of a rod spring type of arrangement. So it has a very stable platform. But it just, you know, our first RG sale was to a customer who loved the radial rocket but was not a tailwheel pilot and just didn't know if he could become one. Chances are you can. If you have good flying technique in a tricycle gear airplane, you can fly a tailwheel airplane. But they are different, and there is some stigma, some kind of tales about tailwheels and that they're harder to fly than a trike and very difficult. But that I haven't really found that to be the case. I think most pilots can transition, but I think the airplane's a good airplane with either gear, but the nose gear configured radial rocket will probably enjoy about a 10-to-1 sales ratio.
Yeah, they're not harder to fly. Maybe a little more interesting to land and take off, but
yeah.
They don't fly any differently.
Yeah.
So, Rob, you've flown tailwheel before?
Yeah, I had a tailwheel. I had a Citabria, which is a little tail dragger, little bag of rags, they used to call it, because it was fabric covered.
Oh.
And I had that for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, and I flew it a whole lot. And I've got some time in Beech-18s, which was a radial tail dragger, and then and some DC-3 time. And once you learn the technique of how to land, how to fly, a tail dragger effectively on and off the runway, there's almost no crosswind that will scare you in a nose wheel airplane because you just learn so much how to control the airplane that it really was a confidence builder for me.
Is the big difference the difference in visibility looking out forward? Is that the big difference?
Oh, well, that is an aspect of it, but I think the more important aspect is the with the tail down and this where the center of gravity is and the wheels and all that sort of thing that it tends to want a weather vane into the wind very easily, which means you really have to work the rudders going down the runway. And people in conventional airplanes just kind of get on the runway and push the power in. Maybe they push their foot a little bit here and there, and eventually the airplane's fast enough they just yank it off the runway. You cannot do that with it. Yeah, you can't do that with a tail dragger.
Interesting. Jeff, how long does it take to assemble one of the kit? Does that include everything that you need?
Well, our kit is what we call a comprehensive airframe kit, which has all the specific radial rocket airframe pieces, skins, bits and pieces for the control system, the canopy, the latches, the landing gear. So what we call customer-supplied items that aren't in the kit would be the engine, the propeller, the engine installation items like oil tank, oil cooler, fuel and oil lines, etc. The builder supplies, you know, his own avionics, electrical system, paint and interior. So, you know, I guess the way to look at it is we want all the airframes to be alike and built as designed. Mm-hmm. The fun part when you do your own custom built aircraft is, you know, doing your panel items, your interior, your paint. And so those items are left to the customer.
Yeah, that makes sense. And about how long does it take to assemble one of these?
Well, that's the big question. It really, the time it takes to put any of these kit airplanes together varies extremely widely. It's, you know, I would say if, you know, I could sit down and put together a radial rocket. Of course, I know how to do it. You know, I could do the airframe, have an airframe on the gear in about 1,500 hours. We have fast build options that can shave several hundred hours off of that. But it's just, there are so many factors that affect the time it actually takes to build an airplane, how long your work sessions are, how organized you are as a builder, the optional equipment, any changes you make, you can just pour hours into thinking, fiddling, trying, redoing. But I'd say the airplane is a pretty typical composite kit aircraft, probably easier than some, probably not any more difficult than others, but you know, somewhere around that 1,500-2,000 hour range, I think is a good point to plan on. And you know, I've seen some fantastically low hours quoted for some kit airplanes, and I just
not realistic.
You know,
huh?
I've built over a dozen airplanes through the years. You know, my own designs as well as the designs of others, and it just takes more time than most people will admit to.
Now, how about build support? Do people, you know, get into this, start going down the path and find that they're, you know, over their head or they have questions that they need answers for? Is what kind of support is out there? You know, maybe just in general, not necessarily for the radial rocket.
Well, I think there's a lot of support. There are a lot of folks out there now who have built a kit aircraft. And like other manufacturers, we're available on the phone, through email. The biggest thing that we've done from day one is the first kit went out with a very comprehensive assembly manual. Our assembly manual is over 750 pages.
Wow.
And it's a step-by-step, do this, do that. I've seen some plans build airplanes where you have a stack of blueprints, and I look at them and go, where in the world would I start? You know, what's step one? So our manual is it's almost like having a conversation on how to build the airplane. Well, do this, and oh, here's an illustration that shows you what we're talking about, and now do this. Here's another illustration. So,
do you have any videos that follow up on any of the building process as well?
We don't have that yet. What we are doing right now is putting together a forum, a web forum for our builders. So, and it's part of an answer to Max's question there about, you know, overall general help for builders. It really helps to have a forum so that your builders can talk to each other.
Sure.
Because they'll have a lot of ideas. And then if you answer a question for any one builder, it's available to everybody else. And I think that's one of the best things you can do.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Uh-huh. And it's great because, you know, the power of the community, you know, brings in all the experience of a number of people. And that's beneficial to the builder, certainly.
Right. And builders often have really good ideas on improvements that can be made to the build process or some aspects of the kit. So there are a lot of good ideas floating around out there. There are some ideas that should be shelved indefinitely.
But
But builders like to, some builders like to change their airplane, and those changes are fine as long as they're within reason and they don't affect the, you know, the basic structure or the safety or flying characteristics of the airplane.
Okay, what's the craziest idea that someone has suggested that you remember, Jeff?
Oh, nothing really pops to mind, but in general, it's where a builder will vastly overcomplicate a simple process. Hmm. You know, they just want to make something that's relatively straightforward to do, harder to do. And it's anytime you make a change to the airplane, I like to say the spinner bone's connected to the tailwheel bone because changes will ripple through an airplane like crazy if you start to really, you know, modify things. Mm.
I hear a song coming there. Dan, can you sing that for us?
Badly.
Connected to no, the... don't do that.
Okay, all right. Well, it was just an idea.
So, Jeff, what does the future hold? You know, with the retractable landing gear, that was, I guess, your most recent focus. What does it look like going forward?
Well, I think we're just going to continue to focus on selling and supplying kits. And this retract system is... I used this same basic system on another design. Most of the parts and pieces had already been designed and vended, so the development and proving process has proven to be pretty short. So we're just going to try to fill the skies with radio rockets, I think.
Well, it's a gorgeous design. I mean, when I saw the first picture of one of those, my first thought was, I need to build one of those. And my second thought was, okay, I guess after that I'll learn how to fly it.
Yeah. Well, it's a pretty straightforward airplane to fly. One of the things that I've always looked to do with my designs is to, even though you're not required to do this with a kit aircraft, is to meet the FAA's required rule for minimum stall speed, which is 61 knots in a single-engine piston-powered type of airplane. I think that's a good rule to follow because now you have an airplane that behaves in the pattern like any high-performance general aviation airplane.
Yeah.
You know, something that I found particularly interesting about your design was that single I-beam spar from wingtip to from one wing to the next, because that's what they eventually determined to be the fix for the T-34s when they, many times they've torn those airplanes apart, but somebody finally said, maybe we should just put one big spar in there somewhere.
Well, our wing is a one-piece wing. It's without the wing tips on it, it's about 24 and a half feet in length, which is about the maximum that's doable in a garage or, you know, somewhere where you could build the wing. But having that one-piece wing with those continuous tip-to-tip I-beam spars for the main spar and the aft spar is just the strongest, lightest, simplest way to build the wing, and it's very robust.
And what's the spar made of?
The general airframe is what's called E-glass, which is the typical type of white fiberglass cloth. But we use carbon fiber in the spar caps, in the caps of that I-beam. And then it's an E-glass sheer web between the caps. And we also use carbon fiber in longerons in the fuselage. So in an airplane in this performance class, you know, the 300-mile-an-hour class or so, the best bang for the buck is not to do a completely carbon airplane, but to do a mix of the E-glass and carbon. And we use the carbon where it really pays off in the, you know, the high-strength required areas like spar caps.
And how much does it weigh?
Well, the airplane weighs about 1,720 pounds empty for a basic airplane.
And for reference, we should tell listeners that a Cessna 150 weighs 1,600 pounds, and it has a 100-horsepower engine, and this has 400 horse.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's our empty weight. Our gross weight runs around 2,600 pounds.
But, I see. Well,
we had a customer with a fixed tail dragger radio rocket that he performed his first flight a few weeks ago, and he has the 400-horsepower version of the engine. And he reports with full fuel, which is about 70 gallons, and him in the airplane, he was climbing at 4,400 feet per minute.
Oh, was that the red and white one you had the photos of on your site?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that's a sharp paint job, too.
That is a gorgeous airplane. So the, you know, power-to-weight ratio is no problem in the airplane. And I've always felt that you could make a big engine act like a small engine by pulling the throttle back, but you can't make a small engine act like a big engine.
Yeah. Good point.
Have you had any third world countries coming to you asking if they could put guns in the wings or anything like that?
No, not yet.
Not yet, huh? Okay.
Not yet. But.
So we can say that we suggested it to you first, so that when they do show up, we can say that we sent them to you.
There you go.
Great. All right. Well, very good. Jeff, is there anything that you could think of that you might want to bring up that we haven't touched on?
I think nowadays it's harder to market an airplane with a specific purpose. So the Radio Rocket is a, like I said, it's kind of like a Harley with wings, with a comfortable cockpit, plenty of utility. You know, it can be fast, it can be economical, and it's aerobatic. So it's a good all-around airplane, good sport airplane.
Fantastic. I look forward to seeing one in the air sometime.
Okay. Well, you know, there are going to be some of the airplane geeks are going to be up at AirVenture this year. And if any of them did happen to find you at your airplane, should we come up and say hi?
Hint. I sure hope so.
Nudge.
Yeah. I sure hope so.
Absolutely.
Okay, you get the first ride, Dan.
Excellent.
Yes.
I'm happy about that. By the way, sorry, Jeff, for not talking to him. Max stole my one question.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Jeff, thank you very much for joining us. You can find New Century Aerosport at RadialRocket.com. Even if you're not contemplating building one your own, you go to the site anyway. Just take a look at this thing. Look at the pictures. Look at the videos. This is one cool airplane. So, again, Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on tonight. I enjoyed it.
Hey, thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right, now on to the aviation news from the past week. Our first article comes from Avweb. This is Cirrus acquired by Chinese company. Now, the parent company of Cirrus Aircraft, which is Cirrus Industries Incorporated, has been sold to the China Aviation Industry General Aircraft Company. And this is something that I guess had been rumored for a while, but it's apparently been sold to the Chinese. Before we get into that too deeply, Rob, maybe sort of for the benefit of our listeners who may not be familiar with Cirrus Aircraft, you could kind of give us a little rundown on what that company is all about.
Well, Cirrus was one of the new generation builders. I mean, we had our guest talking earlier about some of the kits that he built that were very fast and very slick. And eventually, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, companies started saying, you know, maybe we could compete with the Cessnas and the Pipers and the Beechcrafts of the world by building a new generation of airplane that is composite, that's fast, that includes modern avionics, electronics, and just see where it goes. And of course, Cirrus came to be by nature of the two Klapmeyer brothers, Alan and
Dale.
Dale. Yeah, thank you. Alan and Dale Klapmeyer. And of course, there was a lot of politics that went on over the years. But eventually, I mean, I think there were probably over 4,000 Cirrus SR-20 and or 22 models out there. And I have to be really honest. I've probably got 300 or 400 hours in those things now, and I just love that airplane. I just don't want to go fly anything else because they're so comfortable, and that's really what's interesting about them. They're not just new airplanes. They had the inside folks actually in mind when they built them, so they're easy to climb into, easy to climb out of. It's not like the back of my Mini Cooper where if the people in the front are there, the people in the back have their knees, you know, up against their chin. I mean, it's really a lot of room in there.
It's a four-place airplane,
fast.
Right?
Yes, they are four-place airplanes. The 20 has a 200-horse engine in it, and the 22 has a 310-horse engine in it. And so, you know, after again, there was a lot of talk about, you know, various models. They're going to build a single-engine light jet. Of course, that's been on hold for quite a while.
It's the Vision Jet, right?
The Vision Jet, that's correct. And then about maybe 2 years ago, the company was taken over by a venture capital firm, and they decided that Alan Klapmeyer didn't fit the model of what they wanted. And Alan, who was CEO of Cirrus, suddenly found himself on the way out. And ever since then, the company has been sort of privately struggling. I mean, you know, selling airplanes, but still not doing as well as it could possibly do. There were many rumors flying around the industry that Cirrus might go bankrupt here in the near future. And then, of course, some money came from China. And so I think the people that love the airplane are, it's a bittersweet moment. I mean, I think they're just glad to know that the airplane's going to keep being produced, but I think they're always concerned about what does this change, another change in financial management mean.
And China seems like it might be an opportunity for general aviation to grow and expand in.
Oh, I absolutely think so. And I know I've said that to some of the critics that I think one reason the Chinese jumped on Cirrus is not just so they could buy Cirrus, but so they could buy Cirrus and have a ready flow of airplanes to send to the Chinese mainland, because they don't have little airplanes over there. They don't do that. It's just not the way the airspace has been designed. It's not the way they think. But my guess is that that's going to change.
So maybe is the conclusion that this is probably the right thing for Cirrus to have done, both from the standpoint of ensuring their you know financial health and also giving them maybe access to a potentially very large market.
I think it probably is the most practical solution, although I do question why there was no U.S.-backed company that wanted to go after them. Of course, Cessna bought the Columbia company out of Oregon a few years ago, which, that airplane, which is the competitor to the Cirrus, eventually became the Corvallis. And so I think there were some people that thought that maybe one of the U.S. manufacturers, one of the larger ones, might have purchased Cirrus, but it just didn't come to be. Mm.
And we should probably mention also that this is not a done deal. Both governments have to approve this, but they're hoping to close this deal, I think, during the summer at some point. So it's soon, but it does require governmental approval.
Yeah, and I heard there might be a job for Dan.
Ooh.
But, of course, Dan would have to know something about general aviation.
Chinese.
And Chinese. Yes,
right.
We should get you up to speed, though, bud.
Well, actually, I know a little bit more after going to Oshkosh. I know a bit more about general aviation now. So, for example, isn't Alan Klappmeyer, isn't he the guy behind the Kestrel now?
Oh, he is indeed.
Ah, see, I knew something.
We have to talk about that sometime, or maybe even get him on the show.
We've got to get him on the show.
I agree. Next item comes from Wired. FAA okays iPad for pilots charts. This is an article by our friend and previous guest, Jason Parr. And pilots historically have used paper maps and charts. And the FAA is now allowing one company, a charter company, Executive Jet Management, to use the Apple iPad as an approved alternative to paper charts. This sounds to me like it's kind of the start of something that could be significant for pilots, wouldn't you say, Rob?
Oh, I think so. I mean, before that, this even came to be, there were people almost as soon as the iPad came out and the ability to download charts and things came with it. I mean, people were already bringing these things in the airplane. I mean, I can't tell you how often last year I'd see people showing me, look at what I have in my airplane that I can bring in the Cirrus. And I'd say, but the thing already has all kinds of electronic charts. Yeah. But look at this. We can do this cool thing that the Cirrus won't do. And of course, I would always tell students, look, this is very neat, but please remember you have to fly the airplane.
Right.
So I still think this is pretty cool, though.
I would imagine, maybe you can tell us, but I would imagine that, you know, when technology changes like this, probably the process for allowing this kind of a change is probably fairly lengthy, right? I mean, I'm sure the FAA doesn't just look at something and say, okay, yeah, that looks good, and start with it.
You're absolutely right, because the systems that are in place on larger airplanes, they call them electronic flight bags. That technology has been evolving for quite a while, and there are an awful lot of large airplanes that have only recently obtained their certification to allow these sort of outboard computers as electronic flight bags. So the fact that this happened so quickly with the iPad is interesting, because obviously this was one of their targets from the get-go, I think. I think Apple always believed that pilots would find this kind of thing pretty neat.
Huh, interesting.
But now, of course, the one thing I don't think they can do, maybe some of our listeners can help me with this, I don't know if they can play Angry Birds on it while they're flying.
I hope not. That would be a big problem. Okay, let's move on to a little bit of military news. Even though David's not here, the issue from the tanker announcement, I hear angry birds.
Oh, sorry, guys. I'm sorry. I lost my mind there when I heard Angry Birds.
You shouldn't fly with Angry Birds, and you shouldn't podcast with Angry Birds.
I'm sorry.
Okay. That's okay. So last week, as we left the tanker, Boeing had won the contract, and the open question was, would Eads file a protest against the decision? And we have news that they will not. The Seattle PI says Eads North America won't protest Air Force tanker award to Boeing. There's a quote from the Eads North American chairman, that's Ralph Crosby, Jr. He says, after meeting with the Air Force and the Department of Defense and evaluating the information they provided to us, Eads North America has decided not to protest the KCX tanker award. He goes on to say the outcome was decided by price, and Boeing's offer was at a lower price than ours. So I think that, you know, brings us to a conclusion on this issue, although the article does raise an interesting question or issue, that being, you know, did Boeing lowball the price in order to win this? Will they be able to sustain the tanker at the at this price that they've quoted? So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens as we go forward.
Does anybody ever really expect that whatever government contract is signed will actually never change in price? Isn't that kind of...
It's kind of the way it rolls, isn't it? Yeah. And partly that's driven by changing requirements. So while the requirements are fixed as the bidding process is proceeding, and after the award of the contract, oftentimes we see requirement changes. There's that contributes. And then there's also cost overruns on the part of the contractor. And we've certainly seen a lot of those over the years in different programs. But so we'll see if Boeing can come through. Hopefully they can. We see in the Globe and Mail, Bombardier wins record private jet deal. Bombardier's had some good news. They've sold 50 firm and an additional 70 option executive jets to NetJets. Firm order represents $2.8 billion, according to this article, which I'm sure is at list price. And if all the options are exercised, that brings it to $6.7 billion, which would be a record high order for private aviation. Rob, what are these planes? These are Global Express and Global 5000.
The big one. Listen, I'm not talking about this one.
You're not.
Dan, what do you think?
I think it's certainly good news from Bombardier, and I believe this is the first time NetJets has ordered a Bombardier aircraft. So,
yes,
it's exciting.
I think so.
And because I don't know about BizAv, I'm just going to say go Canada for Bombardier, and I'm going to stop talking now.
Go Canada. Okay, well, anyway. And it is, you know, actually what I think is more interesting is that this NetJets division conglomerate, it's been a loser for Warren Buffett, and they have finally turned it around. They changed management teams, and they cut out the fat, and the fact that they're ordering new airplanes now, just as the news hit the street last week about the fact that NetJets actually making money, I think this is a good sign for this segment of the of general aviation in general, specifically. It's starting to come back.
And also, I think I saw an article just a few days ago about Bombardier getting a financing arrangement with a company in China. So I guess that also helps them in terms of, you know, marketing aircraft in the Chinese market. So kind of good thing. It's been a good week for Bombardier.
Actually, since Rob mentioned it, I've just opened Warren Buffett's latest letter to Berkshire Hathaway investors.
Yeah, and he mentions it, I think, doesn't he?
Yeah, he said, a huge story in this sector's year-to-year improvement occurred at NetJets. I can't overstate the breadth and importance of Dave's so-called achievements at this company. A leading provider of fractional ownership of jet airplanes, NetJets has long been an operational success, owning a 2010 market share 5 times that of its nearest competitor. Our overwhelming leadership stems from a wonderful team of pilots, mechanics, and service personnel. This crew again did its job in 2010 with customer satisfaction as delineated in our regular surveys hitting new highs. Even though NetJets was consistently a runaway winner with customers, our financial results since its acquisition in 1998 were a failure. In the 11 years through 2009, the company reported an aggregate pre-tax loss of $157 million, a figure that was far understated since borrowing costs at NetJets were heavily subsidized by its free use of Berkshire's credits. Had NetJets been operating on a standalone basis, its loss over the years would have been several hundreds of millions greater. It said, we are now charging NetJets an appropriate fee for Berkshire's guarantee. Despite this fee, which came to $38 million in 2010, NetJets earned $207 million pre-tax in 2010, a swing of $918 million from 2009.
Wow.
I know that was long, but I just thought that was important.
And so. I think you only took 3 breaths in the whole thing.
Sorry.
But you know what's really, you know what I find really interesting about this whole process is that Warren Buffett actually says, you know what, we screwed up. This did not go the way we wanted to. Well, yeah. A lot of businesses don't want to take the time to They don't want to embarrass themselves by saying that they made a mistake. But, you know, Warren Buffett, I mean, I think that's what they assumed was that NetJets was going to be astounding as soon as Warren Buffett got a hold of it. And that's not what happened. But, you know, Warren is known for not being very hands-on. He tends to want to hire good people and then just let them go with it. But I think even after a decade, he said, guys, we have to talk.
Yeah.
So is the head guy, the guy he mentioned, is he new to the company?
Relatively. He's been there, I think, about 18 months.
Okay.
Rich Santulli, the math guy that came up with the whole concept, has been gone for a while. So.
Okay. And then actually, Rob, I'm wondering, how has the recession overall impacted NetJets? Because I guess on the two sides I could see it is – it would just hurt business travel overall, and NetJets would be hurt like the rest of business aviation. But then again, people who could be looking for business jets who are looking to save money could go with fractional ownership instead.
Well, I think a couple of things. For one, on the fractional side, it did contract, which was no small mess for the aircraft manufacturers. Hawker lost a substantial order. As did, let me see, was it Cessna? I believe it was Cessna that also had a big order canceled from NetJets. And so there was just the raw airplanes that weren't there. But of course, then you had owners with airplanes that were coming up for replacement that were worth much less than they ever expected they would be because the market for used airplanes had practically fallen through the floor. So all in all, it's not been a couple of good years over there. So for them to pull this out at this point in time, I mean, let's be serious. This is early 2011, which means that they had a pretty decent 2010 to make this come to be. And there were companies last year that were not doing well at all.
Yeah, really hurting. Okay, as we mentioned last week, the price of oil has been going up. Reuters has an article, American Air cuts capacity growth as oil rallies. And as I said, oil has continued to go up in price. What are we looking at now, Dan, about $100 U.S. a barrel approximately?
Roughly. I believe, I don't know the exact price, but there's been an interesting spread lately between the two big oil contracts. So West Texas Intermediate has generally been a little bit cheaper than Brent crude. But yeah. We've seen a very appreciable increase in fuel prices over the past few weeks.
So American Airlines says that they're going to look at reducing the growth in capacity.
Yeah, basically they said their capacity growth would be about a percentage point lower, and that's consolidated, so I believe, so including Mainline and Eagle. Yeah, so I mean, look, these airlines are going to adjust. And
they have to, right?
This is lower capacity is one of the ways to do it. So, an American said, actually, one reason there is capacity growth is not necessarily new routes, but, they say some international flying, but also, as American pulls out MD-80s, the 737-800s that are replacing the MD-80s have a more dense, not more dense, but they just seat more people than the MD-80. So,
isn't it interesting every time the airlines think they just about pulled it out, something else comes back to get it.
I know.
I think overall the industry was certainly happy with 2010. I mean, it was overall a good year compared to the past couple of years,
which were disastrous.
I really don't think any airline senior management people were really so happy that the industry pulled off a very low single-digit margin for 2010. And for oil, I mean, I really don't think that many people could have really seen what's been happening in the Middle East.
No, it's impossible to predict things like that or volcanoes or other.
So it'll be interesting to see how other airlines adjust. I would not be shocked if we're probably going to see similar moves from other carriers, but of course it depends how oil moves. But it's just the other thing I think that's interesting is, while I don't think airlines have ever really necessarily stopped thinking about it, but the issue I've been thinking about more often now is fleet replacement. I think high oil only really helps the sales pitch for people like Airbus and Bombardier for the Neo and the C series respectively. So
yeah, you would think so. Sure.
So interesting times as always, but sad, but of course it's disappointing to see the airlines saying, "Oh, we can grow now. Oh wait, oil's over $100.
Yeah.
Damn.
It's like the industry that just can't win.
Mm.
We see from Air Transport World that Delta is going to acquire 9 MD-90s from Japan Airlines. This is for delivery beginning in January 2012. And I guess, Dan, this is to replace their DC-9s and 50-seat regional jets.
Yeah. I mean, Delta has been changing up the mix of its regional fleet. And also, I believe all the DC-9 30s and 40s have been retired at this point. But the 50s, they did say, I want to say a couple months ago, will be going away. So it's just interesting to see Delta building up their fleet of MD-90s, which for a while was a very small fleet, but it says, this article says that if you include aircraft that are currently flying, but the other ones that are to be delivered, Delta has 58 of these aircraft under contract, and 116 were built in total. So it's just weird to see that they have just about, they're going to be having about half of those built. So, and it's just interesting because for an airline like Delta to be increasing their number of an older airframe, not incredibly old, but older.
Right.
But I think what people sometimes forget with the MD-90 is the engine is the V2500, which is what's currently flying on a large portion of today's A320 fleet. And the other thing you have to consider is I would have to assume that Delta is getting a very good price on these older used MD-90s. So yeah. Even if on the fuel side, this aircraft, okay, might not be the most efficient, but the cheaper price helps compensate for that.
Huh.
So I just find it to be one of the more interesting things going on of late.
Yeah, never a doubt. But, again, look at all the changes in general between what we're seeing in business aviation, Cirrus being bought out, some new aircraft coming to the airline. I mean, that's got to overall look better than it was, 2 years ago.
It feels better.
It feels better. I'll give you that. But, I mean, this has been a very slow recovery.
It has. It's been very long.
I mean, just now, this past Friday, the unemployment rate for the first time in a while was below 9%, and I believe it was 8.9%. So, GDP growth has been sluggish. The job market has been very slow to come back.
Ready for some Australians?
They seemed a little bit long today, so who cares?
So would it make a difference if I said I wasn't ready for them? They come anyway.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, March 6th, 2011.
Well, g'day folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk. We're coming to you live from Avalon 11 here at the Australian International Air Show. It's the last day of the air show, and Grant, tell everybody where we are.
Well, we are right in the back end of a KC-135, and in fact, I'm lying in the boomer's couch, looking out the back and enjoying the view from here, man. This is amazing.
You know, you guys are always talking about the problems with the tankers and how old these machines are. I think it's quite comfortable down here. It's quite cozy.
Oh, mate, I'm loving it. I think this is a great place to be. The view is fantastic out the back, and you've got the mirrors there that'll let you look up a bit, and side windows, all the controls here. This is awesome, man. I could totally really enjoy it.
Hey, wake up. We got work to do.
Sorry, man. It's been a bit of a long air show, mate.
We got Senior M and Jason Duckett down here with us. And Jason, you've just for our show, Playing Crazy Down Under, you've just been good enough to explain all the workings of the boom pod down here. And it's been a real treat for us.
Yeah, it's nice to have you down here.
Well, Grant, we ought to get back up and do our report. We're very privileged to be up here. We can see outside the boom pod here, and it's glass windows everywhere. We can see all the crowd down there actually sheltering from the sun underneath the tail of the aircraft. So.
Yeah, instant sunshade, just add KC-135.
Well, Grant, we've had a moderately busy week. Have we found anything exciting to talk about? Anything interesting has happened in aviation in Australia this week?
Oh, well, it looks like the RAAF is going to go for another C-17. That'll take them up to a total of 5 for Australia. That's a lot. So we'll have 5 C-17s. We've also, there's been a few other contracts signed down here related to the ongoing training, and looks like the Texan 2 may actually wind up gracing the Australian skies. We're not sure. But the other great thing that's been seen here, and I think it's definitely going to lean towards the C-27J, is the fact that the little baby Herc with two engines has been doing loops, rolls and knife edge passes. I tell you, mate, there are knuckleheads all over the world crying into their Jeremiah weed, yeah, as their beloved beloved fighter pilots realize that a C-27 can do what they do.
Absolutely spectacular, mate. Well, let's get out of the boom pod here, because while it's comfy, it's quite warm down here too, and we'll finish our report off on the other side.
Okay,
well, here we are back down on the ground. Now we're standing just in front of this KC-135. It's got new engines on it. For those of you who are airplane geeks, here are number 62-3575, and we know David will be madly typing that into his computer now to get all the stats on that aircraft. But yeah, amazing, and the smell of jet fuel in there was quite distinctive.
Huh? What? I thought it was great, man.
Yeah.
I want to go back in and breathe deep.
Especially if any wonder you were falling asleep in there.
No, it was awesome, mate. That boomer position, I loved that. And the cockpit, I mean, okay, so it's not as sexy as the brand new glass cockpit gear, but you know what? I was really happy. It's been a privilege and an honor to be inside a B-52 and now KC-135. Okay, those of you who get in them all the time, yes, fine, yes. You're probably going, oh boy, these crazy Aussies. But, you know, for us, it's a big thing.
Okay, now we're standing here in the area that's at Avalon Airport in Victoria, known as the Keyhole. Being towed back, just as I look behind me here, is a DC-3. The registration there for Airplane Geeks is VH.Alpha Echo Sierra. Beautiful looking aircraft. Looking across here at a C-17 from Elmendorf.
Yep.
And behind that's a KC-10. That one flew in this morning. The United States Air Force has got a lot of aircraft here, and they're pre-positioning now all their tanker bridge to get those aircraft. Some of them are going back to Japan. We believe maybe some are going back to Guam, and the rest are going right back across the Pacific to Alaska and places like that.
That's right. I'm also, in addition to the KC-10 and the C-17, there's a B-1B, two Raptors, a CASA 235, the Spartans. That's a C-27J. That's the one that's been freaking everyone out by going inverted and so on. That DC-3 that's being towed out is actually the Horden. That was the one that you and I flew on a year ago.
Oh, absolutely.
There's another DC-3 over in the background. That's part of the HAAS, Historical Aircraft Restoration Society, who have also brought down a Lockheed Neptune, Constellation, and there's supposed to be a Catalina in there as well, but I can't see it right now. Oh, the Catalina is actually out on the hardstand, a bit before, more to my left.
Yeah,
thank you, Steve.
Black Cat, absolutely, with the Aussie flag flying proudly at the front.
That's it.
Wonderful sight. Now, that's one end of the scale, but Grant, we talked to so many jet jockeys this week. It's been wonderful. We've spoken to some F-22 Raptor pilots, first time we've seen them down here. And what we'll do now is I'll just splice in here a little bit of a clip that we did with a Royal Australian Air Force exchange pilot, or Air Force pilot who's on exchange with the United States Air Force, and he's the first Aussie to fly the Raptor.
So, Matt, you're now on the F-22, and how does she fly?
Well, it's a great aircraft to fly. Very, very easy from a pilot's perspective. The cockpit layout is, they've really spent a good time, good amount of time, perfecting it, and everything that you would expect to transition from like a fourth-gen aircraft to a fifth-gen aircraft. So not only in the capabilities of the, sensors and, what the aircraft actually does out there from a tactical employment perspective, but the cockpit itself is very, very well designed. So I've found that, flying the aircraft is probably the easiest part. Tactically operating it is, a lot easier than what you might expect, because all the displays and sensors are all mech'd just to make the pilot's job just really focus on tactical employment rather than trying to interpret any of the displays and information that might be out there.
Okay, so what kind of displays have you got in front of you?
Well, we've got a number of really large displays which pretty much sit directly in front of the pilot. We've got one, our large sort of center display is what we use as our primary tactical employment display, and it displays everything that the aircraft's seeing. Yep. And we've got a couple other displays on the side which we use for different things in the aircraft, and it's all very well laid out. It's a side stick, so it's not actually a center stick like what it was in the F-18 and F-15C. So what that means is that you can really see everything that's kind of in front of you very clearly without having to look around the control column.
Okay.
Did you find that a challenge to transition from having the stick in front of you, now you've got it on the side? Does that present a challenge when you're working with such, high parameters of flight and, obviously with G-forces, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's actually a very easy transition to make. I think it's going to be harder to go back to a center stick than what it was to transition to a side stick, and it really only took just about 10 or 15 minutes in the simulator to really get a feel for it. And after spent 10 or 15 minutes, you're pretty comfortable in the aircraft, and it was no problem at all.
So. Okay. So the ergonomics of the cockpit, you've got a slightly canted back seat there, not as much as the 16, but a little bit more than the 15.
Yep.
You're wedged in pretty tight there, aren't you?
Oh, it's a reasonably tight cockpit. It's a little bit bigger than the F-18.
Okay.
But, we have some very good flight equipment that we have, and the guys maintain it very, very well. So our G-suit is a little bit different than what you might find on an aircraft like the F-18 or the F-15C. It's a very, very capable of supporting flight at sustained Gs, like up to 9G, and you've really got no problems doing that in the F-22. So,
So you're pulling 9Gs quite often?
Or? Oh, you do. Certainly when we're turning, maybe engaged in some form of basic fighter maneuver type fight, then you'll certainly be pulling upwards of or up to 9G.
So there you go, and proudly representing our nation there, and it's great to see that the proud tradition of pilot exchanges between our two air forces continues, and it has so many benefits for both sides.
Indeed, but let's not overlook one very important part of Avalon. It's not just about the military hardware, although that is very hard to miss. It's noisy, it's big. It's also about the GA end and the recreational end, right the way down to ultralights and powered parachutes. They're all here. I've been around having a few chats with a few guys in the light end. Steve, you recorded a great chat with the chief pilot from Gippsland Aeronautics inside the GA-8 air van. And I've been inside the cockpit of the Avanti 2, that's the pusher propeller turbine aircraft. Absolutely gorgeous. Bit tight in the cockpit but to get in and out, but absolutely wonderful.
And the really cool thing about having spent some time with the chief pilot of Gippsland Aeronautics in the GA-8 air van is that he said, you guys have got to come down here, we'll go and do a flight test. And so that's going to be some left seat time for me. So happy days, Grant.
Oh, you're a lucky boy, mate.
Okay, folks, well, that's about everything for the Australia Desk this week. Sorry we're a little disorganised. If you want to know what we've been up to down here at Avalon, we've put a show out every day. We're very, very tired.
I'm not tired. I'm fully charged on a can of mother.
Yeah, absolutely. And David, I hope you've worked out what that is by now. But an Aussie version of Red Bull, and every bit as disgusting as Dr. Pepper, in my opinion, like drinking fizzy cough syrup.
Oh, mate, it's way better than that. It's not quite as cough syrupy. But anyhow, it's done the job for me. It's helped keep me going all through and running around getting these interviews. So I'm going to head off and start getting some more interviews, and you're going to go back to editing.
I'm going to bury myself in the media center. Until next week, I'm Steve Fisher.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
Well, thanks to Steve and Grant. Those guys produced an amazing amount of content from the Avalon Air Show. It's worth looking at and listening to. You can find all that at plaincrazydownunder.com.
Yeah, and they had some good recap videos as well.
Yes.
So I want to know, because one thing I'm interested in is, Steve has a super sweet setup to edit. So what did he do to, what equipment did he bring with him to, how much editing was done on site, I guess?
they had access to the media center. You know, these guys, Steve and Grant, are pretty good at representing their podcast as journalists, and so they get access to some pretty good facilities at a show like this. So that works out pretty well. All right, next we have Peter Johnson with his European report across the pond.
Confirmé. Top à l'image EAP. Décollage.
That was the Ariane 5 rocket leaving French Guiana last week with a payload for the International Space Station. Today, we're joined by Dr. Lucy Rogers, author of It's Only Rocket Science, An Introduction in Plain English. Dr. Rogers is a chartered engineer with the Institution of Mechanical Engineers, a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society and British Interplanetary Society, and a member of the Association of British Science Writers. Lucy, can you tell us a little bit about your book, It's Only Rocket Science, and why you felt there was a need to write the book?
I was working on a bit of the launch escape system, and I decided I knew an awful lot about a very small area in rocket science, but I didn't have an idea of how the whole thing pieced together. There were some very technical textbooks, so I looked around, discovered there really wasn't anything, so I decided to write it.
What sort of things are in the book?
It takes it from the design of a rocket to the design of the spacecraft, the power systems, but it takes you on to how to communicate in space, how to navigate in three dimensions, what happens to your body in space, how all your guts all float about, where we can go in the future, what we can do. It's all in plain English. There's no maths or formulae in it. But whenever I came across a new question, I would email the European Space Agency, I would email NASA. For example, the only piece of wood on the International Space Station is the wooden toilet seat. Yep, believe me, because wood's combustible and they don't like combustible things up in space.
What's the ISS wave?
If you tweet your post, the beginning of your postcode, if you're in the UK, or I think it's your town, the hashtag of ISS wave and your country code, then your wave gets registered on a map and we can see waves from across the world of who has waved at the space station.
Last week we saw Ariane 5 making a delivery flight. What sort of things are going up to the space station on these flights?
Often it'll be fresh food. I suspect there'll also be a lot of water supplies going up. We can't recycle every bit of water. All the astronauts will get packages from friends and family, particularly the astronauts who are on long duration trips up there for 6 months at a time. Practical stuff, but as well as equipment.
And Paolo Naspoli, the Italian, it's very fitting that a European be on the space station for the arrival of the European vehicle.
That's the first time an ESA astronaut would be there for the ATV docking.
I heard recently that the lifetime of the ISS is coming to an end, and that, you know, that it's going to be deorbited and burnt up.
There is some life left in it, and hopefully we will get as much science out of it as we can. But we can't keep it going forever. One day it will have to just be decommissioned, and it will burn back up in our atmosphere as it comes back down. But it's not too distant in the future.
Once again, the two vehicles now being put in free drift. The docking time, once again, 1:14 p.m. Central Time. They were over Australia at that point in time. Discovery has now made its final docking to the International Space Station.
We have the UK Space Agency, and the contribution to the UK economy from space is around £6.5 billion a year. We have several astronauts who've been to space, and most recently Timothy Peake was named as accepted into the ESA's astronaut corps. Is the UK putting enough funding into ESA and space flight?
Personally, I would love to see more money from the UK being put into space, the European Space Agency, and space flights, particularly manned space flights.
Yeah.
But the problem is, there's only so much money to go around, and the cosmologists and the other astronomers but don't need to get out into space, or even people who are using probes to visit other planets aren't going to have sufficient funding. So to put one person in space, you can maybe send 10 probes to another planet. It's very difficult to make the choice. Putting a Brit up into space is so much more inspiring for children. For children, not just children, all of us. But personally, I'd like to see more people up in space.
Where do you think the future of manned spaced operations is going?
I'd love to see man go back to the moon, and preferably women go back to the moon as well, and even off to Mars. But at the moment, you've got to have the political will as well as the finances to do it, because we've already been there. We lost interest. So even going to Mars, I don't think is going to grab the headlines quite as much as going to the moon did.
What would you like to see from the next decade or so of space exploration and development?
I would love to see some of the more wacky ideas being actually tried out in space. For example, solar sailing, where we use the solar radiation from the sun to actually propel us along. We're actually using them a little bit on stabilization, and I think a new spacecraft has just gone up and deployed, the NanoSail, which I believe is using solar wind to power it. I'd love to see a bit more of that, because it's new and exciting.
And how do you think we can get more people involved in space operations?
A lot of the £6.5 billion a year that is coming into the economy from the UK space industry is coming through our engineers and scientists who are building and designing probes, satellites, spacecraft. So we need young people to be interested in science, maths, engineering, and then they might take it on further.
Well, one of the things our listeners can do is follow you on the internet, and that might get them started. Lucy, where can our listeners find you on the internet?
Yep, I'm on Twitter as Dr. Lucy Rogers. You can follow me there. I've also got a website, www.lucyrogers.com. And we've also got the website for the ISS Wave, isswave.org.
Lucy, thanks so much for joining us. I really, really appreciate it.
No problem. It was lovely. Bye-bye.
You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Thank you, Peter.
You know what's sad? The one thing I thought of about the space station eventually coming out of orbit? And this is, I'm going to blame this on Rob because this is a marketing thing. Because I believe, if I recall correctly, when Mir came out of orbit, I believe Taco Bell put a target somewhere in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Taco Bell?
And said if Mir hit that, like, they were going to give free tacos to everybody.
Yeah.
And that stuck with me for years.
See, actually, the part that I was thinking about, in addition to saying, boy, it's really sad that that thing is going to burn up someday, is that I just want to make sure that it's at least east of Lake Michigan when that happens.
Yeah, you don't want to see any of that coming
your way. You know, remember that video or that sort of that, yeah, I guess it was a PowerPoint or something video I sent you guys where it showed how large the International Space Station has grown.
Yeah.
I mean, that is no small piece of space junk.
Yeah,
that is
it's
going
big.
To burn up.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to a little bit of listener mail. First up, we got a note from Paul Filmer. Paul, of course, has been on the show before and is an outstanding aviation photographer. And he commented on the email we got last week from EZ. You may recall this was the story where he was having his camera taken from him and photos deleted at the Newark airport. So Paul writes, "Photography from a public place is not a crime. They even passed a bill recently that implicitly allows you to take photos of a federal building from a public place. This was because security people were constantly telling people they couldn't take these photos. Recently, a photographer was awarded $40,000 because the police deleted images from his camera. Paul says no one can delete photos or confiscate cards or a camera without a warrant." And then he passes on a link to a pretty useful document. I'll put it in the show notes, but it's basically www.krageshtm. What this is called The Photographer's Right, a downloadable flyer explaining your rights when stopped or confronted for photography. So I think this is something that folks who are engaged in spotting or taking photographs in terminals or elsewhere in and around an airport, you know, may want to take a look at this and maybe even keep it handy as a reference if you're presence is being questioned. So thanks to Paul for sending that along. Paul's website, of course, is skippycage.com. It's worth taking a look at Paul's photos. Some really great stuff.
We like him even though his name is Skippy. Like the peanut butter.
Like the peanut butter.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, we should recognize Paul because I believe that he was our first European guest.
Yeah.
I think you may be right.
Photo.
Yes,
yeah.
I think you're right.
Absolutely.
So he paved the way for Across the Pond.
Without even knowing it. Thanks, Paul. And we got a voicemail from Adam. He asks some questions about the F-35.
Hello, everyone geeks. This is Adam. Well, I have a question about the F-35. All these people in the United States are, like, not funding the F-35. And, like, all the government. Like, recently, in Iowa, they, like, had a thing in the newspaper when they said they're dropping the F-35. And I'm wondering if the F-35 can be, like, funded. And I know that I don't want the government involved because they usually mess things up, but I think the F-35 would be a great airplane. And the government is recently getting involved with the F-35. And I don't like that. How's your thoughts on that? Will the F-35 ever get modeled, and will the United States get any F-35s? I'm just curious. The F-35 looks sick. I watched a couple of videos. And will the F-35 be made in the U.S.? Will the government be, like, shitty and not fund them, like they're saying in the newspapers and media shit? I wonder. Bye.
Thanks for the voicemail, Adam. I think what Adam might have heard concerns not the F-35 itself, but the engines. The situation for the engines for the F-35. The F-35 has been powered by the Pratt & Whitney engine that's called an F-135. Meanwhile, over the years, GE and Rolls-Royce as a partner has received funding for an alternative engine called the F-136. And what's happened recently is Congress has had a couple of votes to end the funding for the alternate engine, the F-136. So, Adam, the F-35 continues, built in the U.S. Orders are planned for, well, going out quite a ways into the future. And the only thing that's apparently not going to be funded now is the second engine. I think that's probably what you're referring to. And that's the best I can do without David.
It was very well done, though.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good.
Why, thank you. We also got a voicemail from Kyle.
Hey, geeks. This is Kyle from Omaha. I just had a quick question about how to find the original episodes. I started listening after episode 90 or so, but I can't seem to find where the first episode up through 89 would be. If you could advise on this, that would be great. Love the show. Thanks.
So thanks for the question, Kyle. Most all of the episodes are available on the website. On airplanegeeks.com. In iTunes and some of the other places, they only go back so far. But you should be able to find and download each episode from airplanegeeks.com, except for episodes 1 through 6. And even though you'll see the blog posts for those episodes, if you try to download them, they're not there. And that's because they were hosted on a service that went out of business. And so those were lost. But we did have them archived, so you can get the first 6 episodes by going to airplanegeeks.com/the-missing-episodes with dashes. So it's the-missing-episodes, plural. And there are links there to the first 6 episodes of the podcast.
2 quick things.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, it's pretty cool that we have new listeners still. So A, we still have new listeners, and B, new listeners that want to go back, which is cool. But also, you know you've made it as a show when you have lost episodes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dan, that was brilliant. You know, I think this school thing is really
working out
for you.
Yeah.
It's getting there.
I mean, on my end, school ends this week, this next week, and so it's finals, and I need a break. I mean, I've got to tell you, 3 classes this quarter, and my brain is melting down. So,
oh, you poor thing. I'm taking 5.
I, Yeah, well, I'm grading the papers, so it's a little different.
Again, whose fault is that?
I know, you're right. I just doing it for money. You're right.
Dave wrote in and had some nice things to say about the podcast, as we're doing a great job. He said, Rob, you may want to close your ears, but I'm especially impressed by Dan's segments. His fleet knowledge and understanding of the airline's financials is formidable, especially for someone so young. Great job, Dan. But Dave's got two questions. First question, he says, is which airline in Europe or the U.S. would be the first to order the C-919? I would guess Ryanair is the easy answer. So do you see anyone else ordering it? I would imagine it would be similar to Ryanair, an LLC with a rebellious streak. The C-919, of course, is the Chinese COMAC plane, sort of in an A320 class. And actually, just this past week, there were some articles from a couple of sources, one including Aviation Week, that said that Ryanair actually is considering the 919, as well as the Russian Irkut, I think that's the MS-21, for their fleet. Michael O'Leary says they are very keen to work with Ryanair. We haven't got a firm offer on price, and at the moment, we don't have certainty about when they will actually deliver the aircraft. He cautions there's a long way from the lovely, shiny brochure to there's the aircraft over there.
As the Boeing people can attest.
Well, yes. I think there are a couple of things. It certainly would be significant for a major operator like Ryanair to order a non-Airbus or non-Boeing or non-Embraer jet. That being said, I want to say I'm a little bit skeptical, maybe, because I think this could be a risk for both COMAC, but probably I would assume probably actually the same thing for Irkut, but also possibly Bombardier as well, is an airline CEO can go say, oh yeah, we're looking at aircraft X, mm-hmm. with the hope of, okay, well, maybe by with Ryanair saying, okay, we're looking at the C-919, maybe Boeing will, maybe that will, it could just be a negotiation tactic.
Yeah, putting pressure on Boeing and Airbus.
So I still think the biggest market for the C-919 is going to be domestic China.
I would agree. I think at least initially, I think that other airlines are going to be reluctant until they, you know, kind of feel comfortable with the track record of the COMAC plane and the Irkut plane.
But. Yeah, or not necessarily just with the company as a whole, and even if COMAC develops more in the future. I mean this isn't exactly, you know, new. I mean, if you look when Airbus started, it was European operators, and then it was so huge when airlines like United and Northwest were big American companies to adopt it. But I just don't see a Western airline going for a non-Western jet in the next year or two. Except maybe I think, though, I'm going to hold that. I think there's an Italian airline that isn't Alitalia that ordered the Superjet, but I'm not sure if that order is still on the book. Let me check.
But, you know, while you're looking at that, I mean, something I wanted to throw in here is that I can't believe that an airline like Ryanair, you know, a pretty successful European carrier, is going to take the risk of a brand new airplane from a company that's never built air carrier, size aircraft.
Yeah, not of that class.
I don't see it happening. It doesn't mean that the 919 will not be successful. It very well may be. I just don't see Ryanair risking its future. So I really agree with Dan on this. And I also, as much as it kills me, I have to say that this reader, what was his name again?
Dave. It's Dave.
Dave. All right. So maybe Dan's smart. Big deal.
What is interesting is I'm looking up a couple of things. I'm trying to look because I want to say there was an Italian airline that had Italy Airlines, though I think is an airline started in Rome, but apparently in January their order was dropped from the order book. But when I look at it, and that's from Flight Global, yes, it's a Superjet Western Launch Company Italy dropped from order book. But apparently Interjet, which is a low-cost carrier based in Mexico, actually has ordered the Superjet, which is, I find interesting, which is from Sukhoi.
Yeah.
So just looking at non-Western airliners, this is an interesting thing to look to research. I'm intrigued now.
And speaking of regional jets for just a second, so long as you mentioned the Sukhoi, has anyone else, I wonder if our readers or listeners have ever noticed that there's a distinct similarity between the Russian regional jet and the old Fairchild Dornier 728 that didn't, you know, that never came to be. Boy, they look like twins to me. Maybe it's just me. I don't know.
That could just be you. I don't know the history is there, but I don't know.
But we have some very smart listeners, some that are almost as smart as Dan.
Yeah.
Who knows? Maybe true. They'll come up with something.
I don't know. If there is ever a partnership with Fairchild Dornier with a Russian operator or a Russian manufacturer or some kind of component manufacturer, maybe. But
maybe they just bought the design. I mean, all the stuff went into the can anyway, so.
Well, Dave has a second question, too. He says, do you think...
Oh, sure, Dave. Go right ahead. We're happy to listen to anything you say. Max, has he said anything about how smart you are?
No. I'm left out of this email. But Dave asks, do you think the airlines and unions have learned their lessons on how damaging strikes, et cetera, can be to both sides? And if not, which airline is most likely to have another shutdown due to labor problems? I guess US Air is the easy answer there.
Have they learned their lessons? I'm going to go with no, and I think Rob's going to agree with me.
I'd have to go with no as well.
Honestly, I think obviously both sides realize how damaging strikes can be, but that's why the strike is the nuclear option.
Yes.
For lack of a better term. I mean, I don't think this is something that it's just part of the process. For U.S. Airways, I don't know. U.S. Airways, it's with their union situation, specifically for the pilots, it's not really with management. It's more, I'm not sure if infighting is the right word, but the issue really has been the integration between the America West and the U.S. Airways pilots, and the East and West pilots, so to speak. And I believe the big issue there has been seniority integration. So who knows? And I'm not exactly sure. I'd have to look up what contracts are amendable right now. But I'll have to look at that. And it'll be interesting to see how contract negotiations go. I'm very interested, and I've talked about this before, especially with scope issues, how United Continental goes.
All right, let me just add in that Dave also has a book recommendation. You know, we've been doing that a lot in the last few episodes. Dave's recommendation is Fly by Wire by William Langeweisha. He says it uses the Miracle on the Hudson as a backdrop to tell the story of the commercial aviation industry, starting with all the participants in that event. So it uses Sully's story to tell the story of pilots, uses the A320 to tell Airbus' story, etc. A great book indeed. So thanks to Dave for all that. We also heard from Gerard. He says, hello, airplane geeks. First, I love the show. Fun to listen with a lot of very interesting information. Now, Gerard says, I am a private pilot who travels relatively often for work. One of the questions I wanted to see if you geeks could answer is, why are there still today ashtrays in the modern airplanes' lavatories? I have no idea. Thoughts?
Because they're tempting people. It's a revenue generator. Because they're tempting people to smoke so that they can grab them and find them and make money.
I'm looking something up.
Okay.
I'm looking something up. You know what, let's follow up on this next week. I've found some stuff, but I don't want to say anything until I can confirm it.
All right, so we'll follow up next week.
Yeah.
We got a suggestion from Jim. Jim says, with hurricane season just a few short months away, how about an interview with someone from the 53rd Weather Reconnaissance Squadron? Those are the hurricane hunters. I'm not sure if they give interviews or even if it's possible to reach someone at the unit, but it would be a pretty cool segment. So, Jim, thanks for that suggestion. David is all over it, and we'll hope that he can get some results. And that would be—I think—that would make a fascinating guest, someone from the hurricane hunters. And we also got a nice note from Diego, and Diego is in Spain. And in fact, Diego has a podcast. It's called Aero Podcast, which you can find at aeropodcast.com. It's a Spanish language podcast, and I think it's a monthly production. Diego had some interesting things to say about the state of the Spanish airports, and that there is a AENA that's in charge of the administration of the Spanish airports and also air traffic control. And it's been a money-losing proposition, I guess, across the 47 airports that it covers. And the government of Spain has decided to give, he says, parts of the administration of some airports and some tower traffic control to private enterprises. So Diego is asking about, sort of experiences with, with that in other regions. Peter Johnson is going to, has actually already communicated with Diego and is going to try to address that from a European perspective. If any other listeners have thoughts about sort of privatization of airports or airport functions, maybe we can kind of dial those in and include those as well.
Well, we have a couple of them, actually. There was Stewart Airport in New York that was one of the first to be privatized. Hmm. And that experiment lasted, off the top of my head, I think about 4 or 5 years. And then that deal was canceled. Of course, they were also going to try to lease out Chicago Midway Airport until about mid-2009, when the economy tanked so bad they couldn't get the money together to do it. Although I think that there was a similar issue in Chicago where the mayor, who is no longer the mayor, Mayor Daley's leaving Chicago, in case you guys hadn't heard that. Yeah. We have a new mayor coming. But the interesting part of that is that Mayor Daley did lease out a piece of the tollway system to a private company for which they received, $1.4 billion or something up front. They also leased out all the parking meters in Chicago. And the reason I'm mentioning that is that it should put the fear of God into organizations that see leasing out public facilities as an easy way to make money, because it may be for them, but what happens in the long run is that these organizations do what they always do. They're private companies. Hmm. They're in it to provide a service but make a buck, and they raise the rates. And we saw that in the parking meter system here in Chicago, and also along the tollway section the city leased out to this private organization. I don't care what the promises are. I know they made some promises to Southwest Airlines at Midway because they were very concerned. They're a huge tenant at Chicago Midway, and they promised them that would never happen, but I don't believe it for anything. Mm. I think we would see some huge changes. And so I would tell Diego, yeah, trust me, I doubt that capitalism works much differently over there in Spain than it does here. Yeah. If someone can charge more, they will.
Yeah. I think the only example I can think of here in the U.S. of a completely private airport is Branson, Missouri. Which is fairly new, and it's been an interesting little experiment.
Well, but wait, are we talking about a private airport or an airport that has been privatized?
I believe it was built completely privately.
Right, right. You're right. Branson was, but in the case of Stewart, that was an old Air Force base that went public, and they tried to privatize it, and with Midway.
And Stewart is now Port Authority in New York, New Jersey, right?
Correct, yeah.
By the way, I have an answer, I think, on the ashtray thing.
Okay.
After Googling around.
Making money?
I don't believe so. Anyway, the Airworthy Director, after finding a couple of blog posts about this, there was a blog comment that got me searching around. The Airworthy Worthiness Directive is 74-08-09. Here are the highlights. The FAA has determined that the ashtrays serve an important safety function and therefore must be considered required equipment. This Airworthiness Directive was issued as a result of numerous fires that occurred in the lavatory paper and linen receptacles on transport category airplanes, which were caused by smoking materials deposited by passengers or crew. Such fires can be a significant threat to the safety of all persons on the airplane because of the emission of toxic smoke and the possibility of the fire progressing to critical components.
Nice job, Dan.
It says, the requirement for an ashtray on or near the lavatory door ensures that there is a safe, convenient, and obvious place to dispose of smoking material. So
that's fascinating.
I found
this after
fun. Yeah, I found it on a blog called Three Geeks in the Law blog, and one commenter put the code for the Airworthiness Directive. But so I googled
that's good.
The
so
FAA.
The
an- and,
so the answer is that even if it's smoking is not allowed, some people will. So they have to give them some place to put out the cigarettes, otherwise they risk starting a fire.
Or I guess any kind of other smoking material, which I don't know what that would be, but I guess in a just-in-case scenario.
Yeah, interesting.
Good to have.
Okay. Just quickly, we heard from Neil. Neil says he has a question. We were talking previously about ETOPS and you know, the early 787s delivered to ANA and if they would have ETOPS or not. And Neil says, how do you deliver a plane to Japan for the launch customer without going over some very large expanses of water that will presumably require the full certification? I think that, you know, without ETOPS certification, you know, presumably you'd have to fly a route that takes you no more than 2 hours from a suitable landing field, which you can do. I think it's you know, there's some hopping that you have to do. And flying from the West Coast to Japan anyway, I don't think you really kind of go across the Pacific. You know, you take a more northerly route that takes you, you know, closer to land. Unless, and I don't know if you guys know this, unless there's no requirement for a ferry flight.
Yeah, actually, and I think there has to be some, I don't want to say loophole, but for example, when Mesa Airlines was setting up their GO operation in Hawaii, they had to get those CRJs out to Hawaii somehow.
Yeah.
And I believe they install like some auxiliary fuel tanks. And actually, if you go to, I'm not sure if it'll still be the featured map when this podcast is out, but I'm sure most airplane dorks are aware of the website Great Circle Mapper.
Mm.
And they have an interesting featured map, which is entitled China to the U.S. in an MD-90. It talks about ferrying an MD-90 for Delta from Asia to the West Coast. And and actually, the author here says that when Hawaiian Air received their 717s, they were fitted with extra fuel tanks. Yeah,
yeah, and I don't think that's that uncommon to add extra fuel tanks when they ferry airplanes. They do that with single engine airplanes all the time. And again, you probably couldn't get away with this stuff if you had people on board, but you don't.
Yeah.
They don't consider the crew to be people, actually. They're expendable. But that is how they get around it, usually, is that they just put enough gas in the back somehow that they can make the flight, and then they make some changes when it gets to the other end. But technically, if you didn't have the fuel capability somehow, you would have to do exactly what you said, Max, which is to keep the airplane within a certain distance of right. Of an emergency field. Otherwise, you are violating the certification standards of the airplane.
So there's no general exemption for the 2 hour rule for
not
ferry flights.
To my knowledge, I mean, unless one of our really smart listeners, who's even smarter than Dan, can find that out.
Okay.
Although I doubt that that's possible. I mean, right. I've been embarrassed enough tonight. I just want everybody to know that. Haven't you, Max?
Yeah, painfully.
Yeah. I mean, well. These whippersnappers, I'll tell you, they're pretty smart.
They're going to take over the world.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we need to wrap this up. We want to thank everyone for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We'd like to thank our guest this episode, who, of course, was Jeff Ackland. He's the president of New Century Aerosport, which produces the Radial Rocket airplane kit. You can find that at www.radialrocket.com. Thanks, as always, to Steve Fisher and Grant McCarron from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. Go take a look at their site. Find their Avalon coverage. It's really some great content worth taking a look at. And also, we'd like to thank Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment. So, Rob Mark, tell folks where they can find you online.
Well, let's see. They can usually find me at jetwine.com, and they can find me on Twitter at jetwine. And soon they will no longer find me at Northwestern University because the quarter's almost done until next time, and I'm taking a break from grading papers.
And Dan Webb, where do people find you?
You can find me online being jealous of Rob because my semester doesn't end until the middle of May. But you can find my website, thingsinthesky.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage.
Great. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. And I'm also on Twitter at Max Flight. See airplanegeeks.com for show notes, links, listener comments, and even t-shirts. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. And we're also on stitcher.com. That'll let you stream us to your mobile phone. You can send email to us. The address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. You can also leave an audio message for us on our listener line. Benet Wilson will give us that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361 Geeks01.
And if you'd like to subscribe to the Airplane Geeks podcast so that you can automatically receive new episodes, you have many options, including iTunes, the Zoom Marketplace, and even the BlackBerry podcast store. Opening and closing music is provided by Brother Love. You can find his great music at www.brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
See you. Good night, everybody.
I want to reach out and be warm and fuzzy and friendly to our listeners. I want it to be like I am going through your earphones or your speakers and giving you a nice audio hug.
That's what they expect. The third,
I think we should cut that out.
We're going to, believe me.
And of course the job market has been slow to come back. All these companies are making money, but they're not hiring anybody.
Yeah, that's
why
true.
Why is that, Dan?
Yeah.
Dan. Oh, Dan.
Dan.
Hello, Dan.
Oops.
Dan.
Did we lose him?
We lost Dan. Let's see. We're trying to get him back.
Did I scare him?
Maybe.
Oh, man. I'm going to go mute here for just 1 second.
Okay.
Who's eating?
Sorry.
Bad.
I mean, especially with the last flight of the shuttle already in motion, and doesn't that Lucy have a neat voice?
Yes.
I thought, not that I'm so shallow that I'm only listening to her voice. I liked her content too, and she really is a rocket scientist.
Yeah. Well, you know, you talk about getting someone on with sort of a space background. I don't know. Did we lose Dan?
Let me look here.
Hang on a second.
To explain so quickly.
I'm back, by the way.
Okay. Hi, Dan.
But did you hear what I was saying, Bill?
No.
Okay. So the thing I remember.
Oh, with the target.
Yeah.
The taco target. Yeah. Yes, we got that.
Okay.
Yep.
Sorry. Did you have anything really valuable to add or, you know?
No, that was it. But.
Are you on your iPhone again?
I am. For some reason, something is, because at first I thought something could be wrong with my router, but my iPhone and iPad have no problem getting online, and my iPad is not 3G. Hmm. So something is wrong with my laptop.
Okay. So we'll just stick with this for now.
Yeah, well.
Okay.
Speaking of router, did you guys see that story this week about the sex game, sex toys at Northwestern University? It was interesting. I'll have to tell you about that offline, Max.
Okay.
I remember reading somewhere that this is sort of like something that's been going on at Northwestern for years, and it's just now that someone's reporting on it.
Well, and of course, I've never been caught before. See, that was really the issue.
Right.
So, but we'll save that for Max for another.
All right.